Conversations with Friends is a new series.
A series within a series.
Creative conversations between writer friends.
We were blown away by the calibre of the pitches we received from established, mid-career, debut and emerging writers.
From those writing poetry, fiction, non-fiction, plays, newsletters and PhDs.
Conversations to get you through these strange COVID days and beyond.
Sit back, stay home and enjoy. This episode of Conversations with Friends is with Danielle Binks and Fiona Hardy. Danielle Binks is a writer, reviewer, agent, and book blogger who lives on the Mornington Peninsula. In 2017, she edited and contributed to Begin and Begin, an anthology of new Australian young adult writing inspired by the hashtag LoveOzYA movement, which won the ABIA Book of the Year for older children ages 13 plus and was shortlisted in the 2018 Gold Inky Awards. The Year the Maps Changed is Danielle's debut middle grade novel.
Fiona Hardy is a kids book writer, crime book reviewer and all books bookseller. She is the author of How to Make a Movie in 12 Days and How to Write the Soundtrack to Your Life, and has written for publications such as The Big Issue, Books and Publishing and Verity La. In 2016, she was shortlisted for the Text Prize. And these two are both Melburnians, still in lockdown.
Oh, it's so interesting. They mentioned this in the podcast, but hearing people who said, oh, we pitched for this so long ago and we thought it'd be done and dusted by now.
I know. Yeah. And we're still doing it 23, 24, something like that, episodes in. We are still here in lockdown, but we are doing fine. How are you doing, I should ask, Catherine? How are you doing this week in our extended lockdown?
A lot better since getting off Facebook. I had a friend, I think probably more than one person, to be honest, posting just
beaches. Oh.
And I know, I just am not sure if you can ever change people's opinions, really. Yeah. Like, objectively, can you? Because I'm convinced I'm right. I'm sure they're convinced they're right. But I don't need to read it.
No. I think that's important. Did you make sure you had some fresh milk in the cupboard this time?
We are swimming in fresh milk.
I'm so glad.
It's just like, the powdered milk is going to go gone. Camping one day in the very distant future.
In the very distant future. My goodness. I love this conversation. It's such a great convo because it's an interesting relationship in the fact that it's two writers, two industry people in terms of the fact that Fiona's a bookseller and Danielle's an agent. Danielle is actually Fiona's agent. So they're very cluey on all things books. They're also both writers of, you know, middle grade fiction, which I love as well. And it finishes, I thought that it was terrific. It finishes with a very in-depth kind of analysis of how the book industry is going this year, which was both terrifying and heartwarming at the same time.
I would completely agree with that. I think it was more heartwarming.
Yeah, I do think if you tipped the scales, more heartwarming.
I think Fiona talks about working at readings, currently sending books out via post to people because people are not able to come into the shop, obviously. But isn't that a cool thing, writing all the little gift cards?
Oh, my goodness.
There's got to be a novel in that.
I did it just today. I called the fabulous team at the Younger Son Bookshop because I have my cousin just had a brand new baby, which is so exciting. And it's just so joyous. Like, everyone feels good about calling a bookshop and ordering books and putting a message to a brand new baby. Like, it was, I got off the phone and I was filled with joy. So yeah. I think everyone should do it. Send books. Just keep sending books to all your people.
I read recently, I can't even remember where I read this, but there's a real challenge. From memory, it was Australian based. Sending books to people who are in prison is like a 100 million step protests because they can only be new books, and the bookshop must have to, maybe it's American, have to fill out certain paperwork.
Interesting.
Yeah, isn't it? It seems like such a strange thing to be preventing, but maybe it's about smuggling other things inside books.
Yeah. Yeah. There's got to be a thousand interesting in there. to do that. I wanted to, I've got written down in my notes that one of the things I wanted to shout out to was that Fiona and Danielle, I think Danielle mentions Adele Walsh, who I had the great pleasure of working with for a little bit of time at the state when I was at State Library Victoria. And she's just such a superstar in the kind of Lovers YA area. I think she's reviewing at the moment junior fiction for Books and Publishing. She has an amazing Facebook group, which these two mention. But she's just, if you are writing YA fiction and you don't know of or know Adele Walsh, then you should. Because she's the bomb.
Oh, that's good advice. And she's how these guys met. And Danielle says that the, because we often think that the intro is like a really critical thing, the, hey, you know, agent or so-and-so, yeah. This is my friend so-and-so, they're writing a book. But Danielle actually says, I hope this isn't a spoiler, that that's not that common, that that results in publication.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's true as well.
To know what the most common avenue is. Winning the Victorian unpublished manuscripts.
Yeah, probably. That seems like a pretty good way to do it.
Just do that. That's my advice.
Yeah. Just enter it with the 35,000 other people who enter it. I'm so glad I did not have to go that route. Can I just say that right now? But these two are just, you know, you couldn't really get two more experienced people to be chatting to you about. Also about writing middle grade fiction, how they came to be writing it and what they have to think about, and because so many of us are buying it at the moment for our middle grade children as well. It's just, it's a great combo. I recommend it.
Hi, Fiona Hardy.
Hello, Danielle Binks, and how are you today?
I'm really good. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I've really got to stop asking this question during lockdown because it really doesn't have the same type of answers that it usually does.
I know. We'll just let people know that as we're recording this, but we're doing so in various ways, but we're over FaceTime, so we can actually see each other, and we're just kind of eyeballing each other as two Melburnians in lockdown. Like, how dare you ask me that question when you know the answer? But it's okay.
Yes. The true answer is the same as I was yesterday and also the day before and the day before that.
Ditto for me. So before we start chatting, I think we should probably let listeners know. Oh, you're going to hear me go a little bit drive time. Let's let the listeners know how we know each other. So do you just want to say briefly how we come to be doing this little gambit? How do we know each other?
Sure. Okay. So the story for me is that I had spent a while writing a kid's book called How to Make a Movie in 12 Days, though originally it was called Rosebud. I had submitted it to the Text Prize, and in 2016 I was shortlisted. I did not win. But luckily, word of what I had written got to your ears, and you approached me and were like, oh, I would like to read this manuscript that you've got. And so I sent it to you, and I guess you can kind of take over from here.
Yeah. So interestingly, I joined, I mean, I think some listeners may know me from a previous first time podcast episode that I did. So I don't want to go too much into stuff that I may have already tread over, though I can't really remember. But I basically became a literary agent in 2016, which was the year that you were shortlisted for the Text Prize and didn't win. But we had a mutual friend in the lovely Adele Walsh, who is a youth librarian, program coordinator extraordinaire, brilliant person who knew what you had written because we're friendly. All three of us were disparate friends. Mm. And she knew right off the bat, as soon as you told her what you'd written, once she got wind of what you'd written, she was like, oh, I have to introduce you to Danielle. And she did. And I said, yep, send it to me. I'm keen to acquire middle grade. I'm keen to build up this wonderful readership that I would like to see more of in Australia. And I read your manuscript and absolutely fell in love with your protagonist, Hayley, and her business shorts, and signed you up, snapped you up. And, you know, the fairy tale ending was Affirm Press acquired you, and you've now got three books deep with them, which is kind of cool. But yes, so we were in similar circles in the Melbourne publishing realms, basically.
I do feel like Adele knows everybody because she's fantastic and just like she just knows everything. She's just amazing when it comes to the knowledge of literature and everything to do with it. So, yeah, she is.
And if anyone listening at home wants to tap into that knowledge, she has a fabulous Facebook group called The Knack, K-N-A-C-K, which is just brilliant for youth literature everything. But, yeah, so anyone listening to this, just know that our relationship and what you may be hearing in this discussion is an agent and her author, I being the agent, Fiona being the author, but we're also friends and friendly and we both Melburnians in lockdown, as we also said. And so I was the one that volunteered us for this podcast episode, Conversations with Friends, and we got approved for it months ago when things were a little bit perkier and looking up, and I was kind of panicking that, oh, were we valid in putting our hands up to do this? We're not really struggling that much. And then lo, by the time it came around to actually record this, it's like, no, actually, we deserve to be here because we've got nothing else to do tonight or any day.
I honestly thought, I was like, oh, it's so good that we're going to be doing this later in the year because we'll be able to do it in person. It's going to be so easy, Danielle. And instead,
we were that
like,
foolhardy.
Yeah. We were. So like, how are we going to make this work? I'm like, all right, there's a lot of cords happening on my desk right now, but it's all happening.
Yeah. I can't move in case I knock something out. But you know, it's nice to see your face and it's nice to chat with you. And we have some fun stuff to talk about. Number one of which we've already sort of briefly covered was you are one of those rare authors who it was a friend of a friend who introduced us and the reason I signed you up, which doesn't actually happen that often in my capacity as agent. Mm. You're probably the only author I've signed up because somebody said to me, you have to meet this person. Ooh. And that somebody was 1,000% correct, Adele Walsh. But I mean, I know the text prize wasn't your whole writing journey. Tell me, how did you start writing? Tell me that little journey, please.
Well, I knew that I wanted to be a writer when I was in primary school. I remember being in grade one and writing a story that was like a retelling of Alice in Wonderland that was like 3 pages long and quite terrible. And my teacher gave me such a compliment. She was like, oh, Fiona, this is so wonderful. I'm like, oh, thank you. And I went home and showed my parents and they were like, oh, Fiona, this is a masterpiece. And I was like, you know what? They're right. I'm an actual genius. I am fabulous at this and I'm going to be an author. And I just kind of really stuck to that. I'm nothing if not like persistent in what I originally agreed on. So ever since then, I just wrote and wrote and wrote my whole life and kind of imagined that I would have a published book by the end of high school, which obviously did not happen. And kept kind of imagining there was a big period in my 20s where I'd write a manuscript every year or two and then I would write one draft and then I would put it in my desk. And I think I was just kind of waiting for some fantasy publisher to maybe break into my house and just steal it and be like, oh, this is great. I don't know what my plan was back then. So it took all the way up until bizarrely after I had a child and was like, oh, okay, I'm going to write something and then actually edit it and then actually send it out as well. And then,
actually treat it like work. Basically.
So, that was kind of how it worked. So I have a lot of other terrible manuscripts in my desk and, but that's been my path. And then also I write reviews. I've written reviews for The Big Issue and for Books and Publishing and for the Readings Monthly as well. Kind of little bits here and there, but yeah. And now I'm 2.3 books into my writing career from here as well. How about you, Danielle?
So I was much like you. I think I went through a really big Sylvanian families phase when I was in primary school and I wrote little booklets that I would, you know, staple together that were illustrated booklets of rabbits just existing in their rabbit lives, much like Sylvanian families.
I love
that. That was big for me. And I was very into like Peter Rabbit. I loved that Peter Rabbit show that was on the ABC with the chick from Heartbeat. That's all I've got. People from a certain generation will know what I'm talking about. Yeah. So I was very much in that primary school niche of I'm going to be a writer one day. And that sort of went away as reality struck. And then the next time that I sort of started weaving stories again was fan fiction. I wrote from the ages of 15 to 22, I wrote something like 600,000 words of fan fiction across like 24 properties.
Wow. Amazing.
And yeah, like in a really big way, I was really into fan fiction, which if people don't know, fan fiction is playing with characters that are not your own and just sort of playing in, you know, pre-made worlds. So for me, it was Dawson's Creek. I wrote a lot of Dawson's Creek fan fiction, Hail Pacey. And I wrote Twilight. Twilight was really the kick up the bum that I needed because I think the big difference with Twilight was I remember being really angry at the last book, Breaking Dawn, because it wasn't very good. Mm. And I remember having very, very opinionated opinions about how I would do it. Yep. And so I course corrected in the course of writing this long diatribe fan fiction, how I would have finished the series. And I think the second that you do that, the second that you honestly say, oh, I could have done a better job than Stephanie Meyer, you're probably going to be an author. You're probably going to go on a path to follow that sort of narcissistic tendency down a rabbit hole. And I did, you know, with a few leeways along the way. You know, I became an agent in 2016 and sort of also started writing my own stuff. But I had also entered into things like the John Marsden Short Story Prize when I was at university studying to be a journalist, thinking that's what I wanted to do, but then secretly started writing my own stuff on the side. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it was a long process, but it was much like you, someone who lived in their imagination, who was captivated by other people's imaginations and just wanted to play in them. And, yeah, eventually realizing that there was a career to be had in various aspects of publishing was just phenomenal to me. It was kind of cool.
Yeah, I have to say, I think it's why because I've been a bookseller now for more than 20 years. And that whole time, I think it was because I remembered how good it felt to read. And I was like, I can create this for someone else one day. And while I was waiting for the opportunity to actually physically be able to create a book for someone, I just sold other people's and still managed to share that kind of love that I had and have. Maybe not at the moment in lockdown, but like in general.
Hey, same. You know, it was Jacinta tapping me on the shoulder one day to say, hey, I've read your blog, Alpha Reader, and I've read your freelance writing, mostly on Kill Your Darlings Literary Journal, talking about youth literature. She tapped me on the shoulder one day at the Wheeler Centre and said, come and join me. If you really want to have a say in what kids are reading and what's on the shelves in Australia, come and join me, become a literary agent. I never knew that was a pathway open to me. But the second that I was told that I could have some sort of, you know, puppet master control over possibly what be hitting shelves, I was all in. So yeah, I'm same as you. The idea of delivering people brilliant stories to get, especially kids, to get kids hooked on stories, that's just the most brilliant thing to me. Yeah. And now, segue, now you and I are also what's called middle grade authors, middle grade being fiction or nonfiction, but in our case, fiction, for those aged between 8 and 12. Fiona, do you want to give a brief rundown of the kind of synopses of your books and how they're also linked together, but in particular your first book that sort of launched everything for you?
Yeah, no worries. So the first one, How to Make a Movie in 12 Days, is about Hayley Whelan. So she's in her summer holidays before grade 6 and she has always wanted to make a movie. She always had a plan to make one with her grandmother. But unfortunately, just as they'd kind of got all their plans into place, her grandmother passed away. She was devastated and didn't really know what to do. But with some of her friends and her family and everyone banding together, but mostly Hayley's own self-determination as well, they got it done. Well, they decide to get it done anyway. But she needs a new main actress who was originally going to be her grandmother, and she knows who would be a good main actress. There is a girl in her class, Rissa, who is an actual professional actress who's starred in Target commercials and everything. And so she, right? And so she wants to get her on board, but of course Rissa is a terrible person. So how is that going to work when Hayley's family is super annoying, Rissa is the worst, and everything becomes chaos when it seems like sabotage is going to happen. So that's How to Make a Movie in 12 Days. And the next one, which is how to write the soundtrack of your life. I forgot it for a second there because I'm writing book 3 at the moment. I'm like, hang on, wait, where am I up to?
It's okay. I'm your agent. I would have had your back.
Okay, and thank you.
Like, it's this.
How to Write the Soundtrack of Your Life is a story about Murphy, who appears briefly in Hayley's book when Hayley comes to her and says, Hayley, sorry, Murphy, you're a musician. Can you please write the soundtrack to my movie? And Murphy's like, she just runs away. She can't even respond. She's too shy. She's a musician, but she can't play in front of people. But then it turns out she does accidentally play in front of her class and everybody loves her music. But then immediately afterwards, her song, well, the song that sounds exactly the same is found online and people are like, well, you stole it. And she's like, no, it's been stolen from me, but nobody believes her because she's never managed to show it to anybody before. So she has to prove that her music is hers and learn how to make some friends in the process. So yeah.
And they are brilliant books. And now I guess I should say what I've written, just so there's some continuity. My debut book that came out in May this year, yes, in May this year when everything was unfolding, was The Year the Maths Changed, which is also middle grade fiction. It is technically historic fiction, though, because it's set in 1999. And I'll just pause here So anyone who is coming to grips with the fact that that does make it historic fiction, just have a little weep, as I did.
Just for the five entire years. Podcast, sorry.
For the 5 years of writing it, I grappled against the idea of this surely cannot be historic fiction, but I can tell you it indeed is. It's set in 1999, and it deals with a year in the life of the protagonist, Winifred Fred Owen Ritchie, whose life is kind of spinning out of control. Her stepfather has a new partner who's moved into their house, and she has a young son called Sam, and Fred finds herself a very reluctant sort of kind of stepsister. Her pop, who lives at the back of the main house, finds himself in rehab in hospital because he had a bit of a fall a few months ago. And she's also still dealing with grief over the loss of her mother when she was 6 years old. And then as all of this is churning up, something happens on the other side of the world that sees a group of Kosovo Albanian refugees fleeing the Kosovo war and NATO bombings. They are brought in and taken out to Point Nepean National Park and a disused quarantine station there, which is quite close to where Fred lives in Sorrento, down here on the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria. And this really did happen. It was called Operation Safe Haven. The Howard era government really did create the largest ever humanitarian exercise in Australia's history when they brought over some 5,000 Kosovo Albanian refugees at the height of their war. And my book, The Year the Maps Changed, kind of becomes about how the refugees' lives become entangled with those of the Sorrento townsfolk. And in particular, there's one refugee, a pregnant refugee woman, who Fred becomes very close to. And yes, that is the story. And I'm just going to point out, I find it interesting, and we can talk about this, but in both of our first books for middle grade, there is a theme of grief that we've both written. And I'd like us to talk about that theme, but also to touch on the fact that maybe some people listening to this are a little bit surprised that we've written something so, I don't know, deep. Because maybe people don't think that that's allowed when writing for kids. You know, is there something taboo in writing grief and sadness for young people? But let's talk about that. Let's talk about the grief in your book, which is the loss of a grandparent.
Yeah, so I feel like for most readers in middle grade, I mean, obviously this won't count for all of them, that the passing of a grandparent is probably the most real grief that they will feel, as in the most likely grief. It's unfortunate, but it's kind of what happens. And I've always found that fiction is a way to explore big topics in a very safe, and I was going to say control, but I don't feel like that's quite right, a safe way where you can read them and kind of hear about what is healthy and unhealthy and how to deal with things like grief and work through it that way. For Hayley, a lot of her grief is in the past, but it's like a big part of realizing that memories are so important and legacies of what a person in your life, you know, how to carry them forward, and even things like conflicting memories about her grandmother, who is not actually always an amazing person. Sometimes she's quite mean, which was really quite fun. Yeah, it doesn't always make her a delightful. It doesn't always mean that the memories of her are delightful, but it's something interesting that I found as well. And I think it's important in a way to talk about grief. My father passed away as I was writing this book as well. And I also found it quite cathartic to think about different ways of exploring that as well. And I think another thing, I've lost my train of thought completely, Daniel, you'll have to take over here until I remember what I was thinking about. I think I got lost up in my own memories then.
I think we both know that kids are a lot smarter than most people give them credit for.
Absolutely.
And I think that extends to emotional intelligence. And again, it's kind of rare in some children's literature that you see young people actually going through the process of grief and emotion and dealing with it and acknowledging it and talking about it. So, you know, in my book, Fred, even though her mother passed when she was six, she's dealing with it now as an 11 going on 12-year-old. And she's realizing that she hasn't dealt with it until this point. There's stuff that she wants to talk about with her stepfather. About how much she misses her mother, about how complicated her feelings are now that, you know, her father Luca has been her father for longer than she was her mother. Mm. Like that's a real transition period for her when she's examining this. And certainly in the beginning of the book, when her family life is changing, she lashes out and is angry. But that's just another form of grief that I think even some adults still have to grapple with, the realization that sometimes when they're angry, it's just because they're sad.
Yeah.
And society teaches us that it's easier to be angry than it is to process grief. And it's interesting to be thinking about this in lockdown, because I remember when the first lockdown happened, we were all being told what you're feeling is grief. And so many people were sort of having to explain that and really distill that for us, because so many people rebelled against it, rebelled against acknowledging, oh yeah, this is a sadness I'm feeling. Mm. So absolutely, to talk about that with kids is an absolute privilege and an honor, because really I think it's complicated for kids. They have these feelings, and something that I always come back to, something that Morris Gleitzman once said, which was adults often think that children have small lives because they are physically smaller. And that's just not the case, because anyone who remembers being, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 knows that they had rich, full interior lives, and they had worries and fears and hopes and dreams. And to not acknowledge that, I think, does them a real disservice.
Yeah, I think it's interesting talking about whether there are things that we can't talk about in kids' books as well. That I even had a friend recently on Facebook. We were talking about a children's book on concentration camps. I can't remember, might have been Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, but I don't think so. And he was like, I wouldn't give this to my kid, who's actually probably, maybe she's about 10 or 11, and saying, you know, I don't think it's okay to read stuff like that. And when I was like, well, that's strange. Why? You know, there are kids out there who, well, you know, were living these lives when they were that age. And he was like, oh, I just think that we need to kind of, they don't need to know about this just yet. It was a really tricky thing as well. But I do feel like, you know, when there are people who are living these types of lives out there, and like, I mean, maybe not that specific thing, thank goodness, but like, it's kind of vital, because, you know, I think authors can be trusted to write about these things in a way that is correct for their age group. You know, no one's giving them, no, we're not talking about atrocities here and things that they shouldn't be hearing. But, you know, you can give an idea of what's going on in the world. You know, kids are capable of thinking about bigger things than what's going on in their own room.
Absolutely. And it we have to also acknowledge that it takes a village to make a book. It's not just an author who makes the decisions about everything that goes into a book. There are editors, and there are sub-editors, and there are copy editors. There are agents who at all points weigh in and say whether or not this is working, this is appropriate, have you tackled this appropriately? And I also come into something else that Morris Gleitzman said, which was, you know, because he's tackled everything from the AIDS pandemic to also the Holocaust. And on the topic of if he thought there was anything that was off limits for kids, he said, you know what, if it's in the world, it's for them.
Yeah.
And that, of course, doesn't mean that you can't just say whatever you want. There still has to be thoughts around context and graphic depictions and language use and everything as well. Yeah. But pretty much he was saying, if it's in the world, it's for them. Mm. And I really believe that, with perhaps the one proviso that if you're writing for young people of any age, teenagers as well, the one proviso I would say is there has to be hope at the end.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm thinking as well, is that I feel like, whereas for adults, sometimes you read a book where everything's very depressing at the end, or see a movie and you're like, oh, and then they all died and that's it. But I feel like with kids' books, you really, they maybe don't have the capabilities of perhaps moving on from an ending that isn't complete in some way. You really have to kind of, yeah, give some hope, give a conclusion. I think that's the one thing that I would say perhaps middle fiction and kids' books do need to have is, yeah, you're right, hope is a good way to put it.
And that doesn't mean that you can't discuss grief and sadness and terror and horror, etc. But by the end of the book, I would hate for kids to be given this sort of bleak outlook on the world, because that's also just not true.
Yeah, exactly.
Any young person, I would tell them, whatever you're going through, it is not permanent. It is not forever. You will come out the other side, I promise you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. And I think you're right, in adult fiction, sometimes delivering on a depressing ending feels, for adults certainly, feels accurate for their lives, where they're at in that point in their life, maybe. I still don't love it.
Yeah.
I don't love the idea of, I just, maybe it's because I'm too much of a youth literature aficionado advocate. I'm too embedded in it, but I just can't imagine leaving anyone, any reader, with that feeling of bleakness at the end. And there's also been studies conducted into the real harm that can come out of that. You know, an example being the terrible Netflix series 13 Reasons Why, which is a book that it's pretty much an ideation of suicide and self-harm, and it's terrible. And there has been real studies shown into the real life effects that it has on young viewers. And I just can't imagine okaying any story like that, because that is a hopeless story in so many ways. So, yes, I think that is the one binding rule of anyone running for young people is there has to be hope. And also something that Kelly Gardner tweeted recently, when a certain writer of a certain boy wizard series caused controversy by just being an awful bigot. Yeah. Kelly Gardner said, you know what, you do not, you respect every young person. You do not belittle any young person's life, which I think also comes back to hope. Yeah. You know, you do not dare give them that sense of hopelessness. You do not belittle their lives and how important their lives are and how much they are absolutely owed a full existence in this world, which I think is also accurate. Very accurate and well said, Kelly Gardner. I also want to touch on the fact that, so you have admitted on record that you're a bookseller.
That's true.
I'd like to discuss for a moment, because I think it's quite odd that we have both, as our debut novels, released middle grade fiction. Because certainly for you, you work at Readings Bookshop, which is a wonderful bookstore chain here in Melbourne. That we absolutely love and adore. You work at Readings and you're sort of the crime thriller aficionado at Readings. You do their crime reviews and everything on the adult side of things. And I think, am perhaps well known in young adult realms because I was the editor and contributor of Begin and Beginner Love Was YA anthology, for instance. But for some reason, the first books that we wrote were not crime adult fiction, were not a young adult novel. They were middle grade. So let's just talk about that for a second. Why did we do middle grade when that wasn't sort of maybe the most obvious choice for us?
It's so true, because I was also with the Ned Kelly Awards and I was on the board for a while as well. Still linked in some capacity as well. And it's been, I actually always thought that I would, not always, but more recently since I've been reading a lot more crime and reviewing a lot, I was like, well, obviously I'm going to write a crime book. And I did write one and it had a lot of plot holes and wasn't very good after all. But and so I put that into the drawer. But what I actually did was this book was a short story, because I had this great bit of advice from Leanne Hall, author of Iris and the Tiger, amongst other books, where she had won the text prize when I started working with her. And I was like, Leanne, what's your advice for how I'm supposed to become rich and famous and amazing? And she said, you've got to write a lot more short stories. You've got to send them out. You get short stories published, you're more likely to be able to get a grant, and I kind of smooth everything over. I'm like, okay. So I started writing this short story for adults about an 11-year-old girl in the 80s who was, or in the early 90s, who was going to be making a movie. Obviously, very originally based on my own childhood, really. And that was my original plan. And then this short story became about 20,000 words long. And I was like, this is not really short anymore. And I was having a great time. And I thought, well, maybe I could just actually write this for kids instead of trying to write it for adults about children. So I went back, edited it, chopped out all the swear words, changed a few of the references to Quentin Tarantino. And that's kind of how this happened. And then I realized the absolute joy I found in kind of becoming deliberately funny. Like, you know, I'm trying to throw jokes in everywhere. I'm making everything a bit more silly and farcical. I mean, it's all realistic in a way, but like it's, I think being able to kick it up to kind of a bit more fun and ridiculousness it really sparked something I didn't even know that I was kind of capable of then. But it really just fell into place, and clearly other people thought so too.
So was it when you took the pressure off? And was it also, do you think that you had become a mum by then as well?
Yeah, actually, I guess it could have been. My daughter was still, like, I think I finished the first draft of this when she was in 3-year-old kinder, and I finally had some spare hours, like two times a week for 3 hours, where I would go to a cafe and write. And that's when I ended up finishing the first proper draft of this one. But she was kind of, I still didn't really think that I was a children's author, I think, even probably as I was writing it, until afterwards. I don't think I realised what was happening. But I think I still have a crime book in me, but it's just hard to cover up all the plot holes. So I'm still working on it. Maybe one day.
Speaking as your agent, I think you do too. But I do think pressure is a big part of it. And I do think we almost have to trick ourselves into kind of saying, oh, I'm just going to go work on this project for a little while. It's not as important. It's not going to go anywhere. I'm just going to have fun with it. And then lo and behold, the second that you start having fun with what you're writing, it comes easier. I kind of had a similar experience with the year the maps changed, in that I knew this story because, much as my protagonist Fred is in 1999, 11 going on 12, I was also 11 going on 12 in 1999. And I also grew up on the Mornington Peninsula when this happened, Operation Safe Haven was unfolding. And I knew I wanted to kind of investigate that time period and that particular event in Australian history. But the pressure for me was thinking, well, people are going to assume that I'm going to write a young adult novel because that's what I'm sort of known for talking about and championing and being a big fan of. So, of course, it has to be a YA novel. And for a long time, The Year the Maps Changed was going to have a male teenage protagonist, and it was going to be set in New South Wales, and it was going to be so far removed from any memories I had of that time period. But it wasn't until I had that voice in my head of the opening lines, which are maps lie, or at least they don't always tell the truth. They're
kind of like a good opening that way.
Yeah. And I instantly thought, this is a snarky 11-year-old. This is an 11-year-old that has gone through it and is looking back on this time period, and she's got some stuff to say. And that was a little bit me, you know, a little bit me. So the second that I kind of allowed myself to remember what it was to be that age, and the second that I set it where I live, close to home, it mattered more to me. You know, the stakes were raised in the writing of it, and it mattered more to me. And that was the fire that I needed to get started. So in some ways it was taking the pressure off, you know, the pressure of people are going to expect a YA novel. But in other ways, it was just applying pressure to a different part of my brain and saying, there are stakes now. This is going to be read by locals. This is going to be read by family who are going to know that it's largely inspired by that year in your life. And I mean, I did things like Fred in the book has got a policeman father. My own father was a policeman for 17 years of my life. Her grandparent that lives at the back of the main house, my grandmother lived at the back of the main house.
Mine too.
I love that. I love that we both acknowledged that grandparents have a really big role to play in the raising and upbringing of kids, which I don't think is always talked about openly, but that is increasingly the norm. It just is. So, yeah, I find it really interesting that we had to apply pressure in different ways and alleviate pressure in order to write the thing that we wrote. But we are, in our respective ways, kind of still following that thread for our next works and our next projects. My next project being YA and your next project being another middle grade novel. But as you said, that you have some ideas in the works for crime fiction, which I'm just going to let stew. I'm just going to let them simmer because I can't wait for you to have an adult crime fiction novel. Yeah, I can't wait for that.
I think the hard part for me, and this is ridiculous to even pretend to be complaining about this because I'm not really, is that I don't have the time, because I think at the moment I've been churning out a novel a year, as in, so I published How to Make a Movie in 12 Days in August last year, and How to Write the Soundtrack of Your Life will be coming out in August this year, which, again, terrible timing, right in the middle of like week four of hard lockdown. So I'm relying on all the other states to help me out here because Victoria is not going to be very much of a success for me. And so, yeah, and with the theory as well that my third book, which is currently called How to Tackle Your Dreams, will be coming out next August as well. So with that, working on a book a year while also holding
a job. That's a lot. Yeah, that's a lot.
and parenting and currently home learning with my daughter as well. It's been, I'm like, I don't have any spare time. I've usually got like maybe 3 or 4 weeks a year in which to work on this crime book. So it's happening very slowly, and I have to try and remind myself of the entire plot line again every time I come back to it.
Again, I think just wait for that pressure to alleviate and something good will happen. But I mean, now you've also gone and said the big L word, lockdown, which also leads to the big C word, which is COVID, coronavirus, etc. We've touched on the fact that, interestingly enough, you being a bookseller and me being an agent, we both together have a kind of overview of what the industry is doing right now. And, you know, let's talk about that. Let's assume that anyone listening may want our insights into how things are going and maybe what they can do to help improve things or help things along in the publishing industry, because Lord knows the Australian government ain't doing a lot for the arts. It is down to us. Scotty's gone on holidays again. I think he's been on holidays this whole time. They ain't helping us. And as we're recording this, Writing New South Wales, for instance, is under threat of kind of dissolving because they didn't get their funding. And that's a lot of writers who have not been guaranteed work. I think this comes out of cultural funds where only 5% of projects were literary projects. So, you know, it's tough at the moment, but let's give a little overview of what we've been seeing from our respective sides of the industry. If you'd like me to go first.
Go for it.
I can tell you that stuff is being sold. I can tell you that sales-wise, from what I can understand with my kind of looking at my author's sales, youth literature is actually doing pretty well. Middle grade nonfiction in particular has done really well, obviously to aid at home learning, but middle grade on a whole has done relatively well. Anecdotally, every time I went into a bookshop, and you can definitely talk about this more because this is your arena, but I was hearing from booksellers saying, yeah, parents were wanting middle grade. They were wanting it for that exact age group, probably to alleviate screen time. Also probably because families are at home now and can actually read books together, potentially. So youth literature has held up pretty well. And I was just also watching the ABC News the other day where the microcosm of Perth, they were speaking to suburban Perth independent booksellers who were saying, we've had like a 30% increase from last year in sales because people were actually coming in and not just buying two or three books, but were buying eight books in one pop. Coincident, but, you know, on the flip side of that was Perth proper in the CBD was saying, yeah, we've had no foot traffic. It's been really down. I can tell you that I think sales from last year overall were down 5% in Australia, which is better than somewhere like Germany that were down 10% of sales overall. But of course, Germany's had more lockdowns than us. And we have to remember, even though we're Melburnians and we think that the entire Australian world revolves around Victoria,
excuse
we have
me,
to remember,
it does.
I'm winking over FaceTime to you. We know it doesn't, wink, wink. The truth is, though, that the rest of Australia is still chugging along.
Yeah.
You know, bookshops are still open. Jenna Guillaume, who just released her fabulous book, You Were Made For Me, this week as a recording, has gone and visited bookshops with a mask on, being very socially distant and brilliant. But bookshops are still open and doing trade and being amazing, and it's harder in Melbourne right now. But overall, I can tell you that I've been selling books. Jacinta from, you know, the partner at Jacinta Demarzay Management has been selling books across the board for adults, for kids, for picture books, etc. There are some projects that I'm really excited about that have had huge publisher support behind them for titles that are going to be coming out next year in 2022 and also a little bit beyond. It's looking kind of healthy-ish. You know, even though we're all sort of very uncertain, even though all of those international book fairs and conferences got cancelled, although I was invited to an international book fair and had to, I had to turn it down because I was like, I don't think it's going to happen in Europe, because the week that I had to turn it down, Europe kind of went through their big second wave because the weather got nice and people wanted to go to the beach. But I kind of had to say to them, I can't go because I'm pretty sure you're going to be in lockdown, but I'm definitely in lockdown and I wouldn't know how to get a plane out of the country. I wouldn't even know how to cope with my panic if I had to get on an international plane. Like, I just couldn't even fathom it. But yeah, I can tell you all those international conferences have either moved online or have just been postponed for the year, and who knows what's going to happen. So that's a little bit sad. But I can also tell you that I think maybe a small silver lining of this, it feels a little bit macabre to say, but because America in particular is going through so much turmoil with their coronavirus response, which is pretty much non-existent, I'm wondering if the output of, in particular, American young adult literature is going to probably be on the decrease, which may mean that Australian publishers have to look to their own backyards to find new voices and to fill those voids, which could be kind of great for us, much as it's terrible to think of that on an international scale. But yeah, overall, I just want people to know that stuff is selling, stuff is being sold. I can assure you that stuff is coming down the pipeline to be released next year and the year after that and the year after that. Yeah, what do you think as a bookseller? What's your overview of what's been happening?
So I'm going to go for a bit more of a, I guess, a smaller scale here, which is the bookshop that I work in. Obviously, our sales have been significantly down, mostly because of our shops. Only one of them, well, all of them are now closed. The State Library shop has been closed for the majority of the past few months and since March. So we, as somebody who's usually doing face-to-face sales, and suddenly we are exclusively online, I'm now working in the warehouse and I'm seeing that we still are doing a lot of deliveries. Like the absolute scale of deliveries we are doing now is incredible from what we used to do. I've been like, now I have to learn all these new things to be able to send books out.
And I feel like a lot of that down to me. I've bought so many books from readings in lockdown. It's my coping mechanism. You're so welcome. I think that's a completely legit coping mechanism.
It's kind of both heartbreaking to see how, how hard it is, how our sales are down, but also amazing to see how many people are just still ordering online. One of the sweetest little things about it is when I'm doing packing specifically, people will say, please write this note. And then I'm writing little notes out for people. And all these really lovely people are like, oh, hi, beautiful grandchildren. I'm sorry that you're in lockdown. I hope you enjoy this. Aww. Or, someone else saying, oh, have a really lovely time. I love this. I hope you will too. Love Auntie Danielle. Like they're just, I'm writing so many little cute messages to people in support for their like lockdown sadness. So everybody's looking out for each other. I can really feel a sense of it. And booksellers as well. Like I feel like local booksellers all around Melbourne are really helping each other's communities out and doing the best that they can in every way that they can as well. And looking around at all those other bookshops around the country as well and seeing how they're going and seeing their kind of semi-normal lives, I'm like, oh, I'm so glad it's still happening out there as well and looking forward to the day when it happens for us as well.
I also feel like, for a long time we've all been talking a big talk about shop local, support local, and it feels like the pandemic really crystallised that for a lot of us. It was us kind of saying, hey, if you really want to see this shop that you love, this little locally owned shop survive on the other side, you have to support them now. You have to support them now. And I think we've been seeing that, and in bookshops especially, and the writing community, the publishing community, just the community generally have been acknowledging that, hey, a bookshop really is the beating heart of a community. There is really so much more outreach that they do than you even realize. They have connections to the schools. They have connections to all the communities. They are really what help build communities and bring them together. So I think that's been really beautiful and wonderful that we've all been talking about that.
And even things like seeing all the stores and how they have changed from launches in person to online launches and how good they are. Like it's been, because that's amazing to see from like an accessibility angle as well, and how many more people who can now participate in other places they can't get to because they're too far away or for a myriad reasons that they might have for not being able to get to a launch. And now they are available. And it's something that one of those things you're like, okay, this is something maybe we can do in the future, something that we can continue. It's amazing and means that everybody gets to celebrate things that they would love to otherwise.
And I can tell you, I represent Carly Findlay, whose wonderful memoir, Say Hello, is about her being a disability advocate and an appearance advocate as well. And she is someone who said, the disability community has been asking for more access for events for a long time. And it's kind of sucky that it took this to happen, but it's making people realise, the fact that you can have more people come to your event who couldn't be here otherwise, either because they just couldn't make it out for an evening event, that they couldn't juggle work and home life and getting on public transport, maybe they didn't feel safe doing that, also because just a venue wasn't accessible for them in some capacity. I mean, there are still some glitches. I would say Zoom is not great for subtitles and everything like that for various communities. But I hope that's something that we can figure out in future and carry this over to the other side, whatever that looks like.
Yeah.
I hope we can see the silver linings of this. And I will also just say, given that we've been talking about the book sales and people are selling books and et cetera, I just also want to acknowledge that it's okay if you're just in the creating stage and you're grappling with that in lockdown. And I've been carrying in my heart a tweet that a US commentator, Talia Lavin, said early on when this all started, and that was, she said, if you're writing or editing or working on a book right now, it may be incredibly difficult because the future is so uncertain, but every word you put on paper is an affirmation of the fact that there will be a future. It is a profound act of faith. And I just think that applies. It applies to everything. It applies to, I think it's a profound act of faith to purchase a book from your local independent bookseller and say, no, Jeff Bezos, you do not need to make another $1 million this minute.
Please do not.
It's a profound act of faith to say, I want to invest in this side of community and I want this part of my community to come out the other side and I'm going to help them be part of that. I think that's all a profound act of faith and it's been really beautiful and humbling. So hopefully that's been the feel good portion. I think you're giving me the signal that we should wrap up soon, but I think we should end on, let's do a big recommendations as the end. Let's talk about things that we've been loving, watching, reading, listening to. I can already do a shout out to Taylor Swift's Folklore. I'm obsessed with it. Tell me, what have you been reading?
Phoebe Bridges.
What have you been reading and watching?
Okay. So not as much as I had hoped. Actually, on the kids aspect, because I've got a middle grade age child, we've been mainlining a few of the TV series. Like, we've finally done Avatar: The Last Airbender and She-Ra, which we've had a very, very great time
with. I love She-Ra so much. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, best so show. Good. But also, have you watched The Investigators?
No.
INB Investigators. Okay, so it is a kids' TV show, Australian ABC, about these group of kids who start up a detective agency in their school. It is the most supremely Australian primary school experience you will ever have. I watched the first few episodes and I was like, this is okay. And now I'm so fully invested in every single thing that's happening that I, like, we have just been watching repeat episodes. It is a good
that
time.
Is amazing.
Like, I don't know. It's a really fun show. So, I mean, again, because I've got a kid, I just will happily watch kids shows all day. I'm not sure how I'd feel.
No, my comfort viewing in lockdown the whole time has been Bluey.
It's Bluey. Oh, it's the best thing in the
Bluey
world.
Bluey is absolutely setting the bar for how we write anything for kids. It is honestly some of the best written television I've seen in my entire life. And it's not just because it's for kids. It's not the best television I've seen written for kids. It's the best television. Like, some of those episodes are so profoundly moving, I tear up watching them. And I don't have...
Oh, yeah, all the time. Oh, my gosh, the one... The mother one with the son, I can't believe. Sleepy Time.
Yes.
Bedtime?
Sleepy time.
Oh, my gosh.
Where they're going through...
Every time I watch it, I'm like...
space and time. Ugh. It is the most profoundly moving show.
Cry torrents every time I watch that one.
I feel such a rousing... it's the one time I feel sort of nationalistic pride is when I see the US starting to cotton on to how great Bluey is, and it gets write-ups in the New York Times. I'm like, yes, Bluey is the best of us. Don't mind Scott Morrison. Maybe you can be fooled into thinking that Jacinda Ardern is ours, but she's not. I'm so sorry. But Bluey is ours. And I'm just really, really humbled by how brilliant it is. So that's my recommendation as well. I also loved The Old Guard on Netflix.
Oh, yes, that was a good time.
That was such a good Charlize Theron movie. Truly brilliant. I also really loved the Mindy Kaling produced Never Have I Ever. Was just brilliant. And then as for reading, I've got Will Kostakis's second book in the Monument series to read, Rebel Gods, which I'm really excited about. I've got like 100 pages to go on the latest Karen Slaughter book, the 10th book in her Grant County series, I'm obsessed with Karen Slaughter. But if I ever have an inkling of maybe I want to write crime one day, I have to read her. And then I'm like, no, I'm not ready to write crime one day. She's too good. And then I think people might be surprised that I'm mentioning stuff that's not youth literature. But I also want to give a shout out to, I bought Zadie Smith's very short essay collection, Intimations, which is 6 essays that she wrote during the beginning of the UK lockdown. And I was... moved to tears while reading it, just because she's such an honest, beautiful writer. And even in her foreword, the last line of her foreword was just the most sublime thing that I could think of for encouraging anyone to have a go at writing and telling their story, when she said, "Talking to yourself can be useful, and writing means being overheard." And I just loved that. And
She's so good.
Maybe that's a note to end on and say thank you for listening to us and overhearing our conversation today, our conversation with friends in lockdown. And thank you to the First Time Podcast for having us. And, you know, stay safe out there, everybody. Stay safe.
Yes, thank you so much, Danielle, and to the First Time as well. I always love listening to this, and I've been listening to all the conversations with friends as well on my brief jaunts outside on my own. So not a lot lately.
The 1 hour a day yard time. Days. Yeah, it's been great.
Yeah. But no, thank you so much, Danielle, as well.
Thank you, and I'll see you on the other side.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.
This series is supported by the City of Melbourne through a COVID-19 arts grant.